Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. EPA a year ago rolled out plans to promote renewable energy and limit carbon emissions. The Clean Power Plan, as it's known, requires states to establish strategies to cut emissions by about a third by 2030. 6 months later, the U.S. Supreme Court put the CPP on hold. And yesterday, Ohio joined 26 other states in their arguments before the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia against the plan. They argue that the Clean Power Plan infringes on states' rights. Coming up, we'll take a look at efforts in Ohio to reconstitute energy mandates here after a two-year freeze. Joining us now by phone is Midwest Energy News reporter Kathy Kowalski. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So Ohio, as I said, is one of 27 states to challenge the Clean Power Plan in court. I said, based on states' rights, what's the fundamentals of their challenge to this?
Well, there are several different arguments. One is that EPA is regulating emissions beyond the fence of a particular plant, and that states feel, or the challenging states feel, that EPA is telling them that they must make a shift in their power generation from fossil fuel-based generation to renewables, or to go from coal to natural gas. And so they are saying that there is this mandated requirement that they must make this change. The response to the, and there are other arguments too, but the response to that particular point is that EPA has regulated beyond a plant's facility for various other types of pollution, and that states have flexibility in deciding what they do or don't want to do. States have the option of not doing anything, in which case a federal plan would kick in. And that's pretty much the standard format that follows for most other types of regulatory programs under the Clean Air Act.
You mean in that they set goals and the states can figure out how they want to achieve those goals, and if they don't want to figure it out, the feds will do it for them?
Correct. The feds will do it for them, and then people have to comply with it, and then the feds enforce it. Another argument hinges on the statutory authority and whether EPA can go ahead and regulate under Section 111D versus not at all. And the argument there is that power plants are already regulated to some extent on other emissions under other provisions of the Clean Air Act, and therefore they cannot be regulated under both provisions. The states that are backing the Clean Power Plan and various other supporters, as well as EPA, say, look, this is kind of like a pick-your-poison kind of argument. One of the lawyers who was arguing before the Court for the Environmental Defense Fund characterized it as a restaurant, basically, you know, having to comply with both food handling requirements and a fire safety code. There's also a question about, you know, whether these standards are impossible to meet in terms of, you know, well, gee, if we continue to run all of our current generating plants in Ohio as it looks right now, we would not be able to meet this under a business as usual kind of situation. And those kinds of arguments, again, from the other side, the way they would look at it is say, you know, the Clean Air Act has always been kind of a technology forcing law. Similar arguments were raised back in the late 1970s. So that's kind of the general overview of the big arguments that are being raised.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the breadth and the depth of the Clean Power Plan. It's on hold right now while 27 states challenge it in U.S. Circuit Court and federal courts. My guest right now is Kathy Kowalski. She's a reporter for Midwest Energy News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. Coming up, we're going to get at that issue of the freeze of the Ohio mandate that started 2 years ago and will end sometime in 2017. If you have a question or comment about that, wait until the next segment. We'll get to that issue as well with one of the key supporters, one of the key sponsors of the legislation that put that freeze into effect. 21 states involved in the lawsuit are on track to meet the requirements, and that did include Ohio before the freeze. Where does Ohio stand in that category now? Is it on track or not anymore?
Ohio, as I understand it, could still be pretty close to being on track. There are a couple of ripples, though, that take place there. One is what's going on in terms of the addition of solar and wind energy, and separate from Senate Bill 310, which put the two-year freeze in place, there was a last-minute amendment made to a huge budget bill in 2014 that tripled the setbacks for wind farms. So that makes it very difficult to add new commercial-sized wind farms in Ohio.
That would mean the setbacks, meaning how far or how close the turbines can be to other properties.
Correct. So that's a factor that could cause a ripple there. But otherwise, we were pretty close to it and still could be pretty close to it. Nationwide, the Clean Power Plan is looking for a reduction of up to 32%, which is about a third nationwide. Mm-hmm. And they kind of weighted that based on the energy mix in each state. So we've also had, in this case, in this state, a couple of extra coal-fired power plants closed. So, you know, that has some effect on it as well. I mean, there are market forces that are also going on here.
Where are, besides the states' rights issues, in the business community, in the utilities community, are they opposed to the Clean Power Plan? Are they opposed to Ohio's energy mandates that are now frozen but could resume?
It depends upon which sectors of the business community.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Murray Coal is a very large coal producer based in the state of Ohio, and the company issued a press release yesterday condemning the Clean Power Plan. They were one of the companies that's challenging it in the federal courts. So they very much are opposed to it because they see it as a threat to the continued ability of coal to be a viable energy source. Some other groups, large industrial plants are also opposed to it. On the other hand, you have some other groups in industry that deal with, say, you know, renewable energy, or groups in industry that are, say, smaller manufacturers who want more of the flexibility. So it's hard to say that there's an across-the-board division there, but you have the National Association of Manufacturers was against it. There are some other large business groups that oppose it. And part of that is they may perceive that their rates would go up, or they may currently have some very favorable rates with utilities based on the use of fossil fuel power.
If the CPP is restarted, what happens to the states that don't meet the standards deadline? So it's been, you know, I mean, are some states just moving forward as if it is going to be reinstated, or how's that working?
Some states are moving forward as if it is going to be upheld and take effect. Other states, like Ohio, has basically not said anything but really hasn't done anything further on complying with the plan, so it's kind of in hiatus. But other states have basically put the brakes on and not done anything else. There's an argument that could be made that, oh, well, you didn't submit a plan, blah, blah, blah. You should now have to take the federal plan. But the general understanding seems to be that once the litigation is concluded, there would be some sort of time allowed then for states to get their plan in. It's not clear whether the final deadlines under the rule would change or not. Frankly, they're looking at, you know, the first deadlines coming due in the early 2020s and then final compliance in 2030. So it's pretty far out still. So that might not actually need to be adjusted.
Is this something that if there's an administration, well, there's going to be an administration change, but that a new, whoever the new president is, could just put the kibosh on it altogether?
Yes, but it's not that easy.
Okay.
Or it's not that simple. If a president is hostile to the Clean Power Plan, one would need to somehow take action in the agency to rescind the rule, or to do something through rulemaking to withdraw it once it's in the courts. Because you can't just say, oh, that rule no longer exists. There is also the old ploy of, you know, the president could choose not to enforce that rule at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one would be taking regulatory action, two would be just not enforcing it. The third ripple that comes up is that if a president is hostile to the Clean Power Plan, that person could then... Well, in any case, that person will be having some influence over which judges get appointed to the courts. The decision in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is being decided by a panel of 10 judges. It is possible but unlikely that that would split 5-5. A more likely split is... Perhaps. I mean, you're looking at a panel that's got 6 Democratic appointees and 4 Republican appointees. Either way, the decision is likely to be appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has a vacancy right now,
mm-hmm.
and it's not clear at all how soon that vacancy is going to get filled. If you still have a vacancy or have somebody sitting out the decision, you could get a 4-4 split on the Supreme Court, in which case the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals would stand, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different permutations that could take place.
Are we talking about years from now that this will be resolved, or what's your sense about that?
The analyses I've read suggest there may not be a decision from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals before the presidential election.
Okay.
That could be wrong. I'm not entirely sure why the D.C. Circuit decided, instead of having a regular 3-judge panel, to go to the on-bank decision. So that's just not clear to me. But if there is a decision, let's say, sometime this fall or before the end of this year, then that would be appealed to the Supreme Court. Probably they would decide to hear it since they had decided to grant the stay back in the winter. The briefing for that and the argument, it might be all finished and get decided by next June, or it might be carried over till the next term. But it's not likely. It almost certainly won't be beyond 2018. It would likely happen, I think, in 2017.
And the arguments were yesterday in the Court of Appeals in D.C. Do they continue today?
I don't think they continue today.
Okay. So that's it. Now it's in their hands. And
it's in their hands. There were 4 hours of arguments yesterday. I did not see anything when I checked that said arguments were continuing today. So I believe the arguments are done. And one of the other issues, if it were to go up to the Supreme Court and also before the D.C. Circuit right now, is that there were some Supreme Court opinions that came out previously telling EPA that they had to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. And so trying to distinguish those decisions would be challenging or would require somehow for the Supreme Court. I mean, either the D.C. Circuit would have to say those decisions do not apply to this because of one reason or the other, mm-hmm. or if it went to the Supreme Court, they would have to either distinguish those other cases or find some way to overrule them. There's also a question about an ambiguity in the statutory language that I think the New York Times referred to as a clerical error issue in terms of whether something could be regulated under one section and another or under one section or another. And there's a rule of constitutional interpretation that if there's any way to read a statute so it will be constitutional, a judge is supposed to do that. And that's, for example, why the Supreme Court upheld President Obama's health care plan.
Okay. That is Kathy Kowalski, reporter for Midwest Energy News. We've been talking about the possibilities for the Clean Power Plan now being challenged in federal court, which will decide probably sometime after the November election. We'll continue our conversation and move into the freeze on state green energy standards that once required utilities to increase each year the amount of green energy sold to consumers and encourage energy efficiency. We'll get to that with one of the chief proponents of the measure. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 2 years ago, Ohio lawmakers froze state green energy standards that required utilities to increase each year the amount of green energy sold to consumers and to also encourage energy efficient standards. The freeze was enacted to study the impact of the standards on consumers and producers, including coal and gas interests. Coming up, we'll hear from one of the critics of the freeze. Still with us is Midwest Energy News reporter Kathy Kowalski, and joining us now by phone is State Senator Bill Seitz, a Republican from Cincinnati and one of the chief sponsors of the freeze. Welcome back to the show, Senator Seitz.
Happy to be with you, Ann.
What did you learn from the freeze?
What we learned from the freeze is, number one, voluntary efforts to add more green energy to Ohio's grid continued. Large corporations are doing this as a matter of voluntary choice to appease their shareholders or to appease activist elements within their shareholder group. We also learned that the requirements, the mandates for higher green energy are costing consumers about 8% on the generation side of their electric bill. We learned that Ohio is not a particularly resource-rich state for either wind or solar compared to windier states or sunnier states. And we learned that the advent of the federal Clean Power Plan further complicates matters because it threatens to impose new and additional federal mandates that may or may not sync up correctly with the Ohio statutory green energy mandates. Therefore, the study committee that was created by the bill that you mentioned recommended that the freeze continue until there is greater clarity around whether the Clean Power Plan will survive judicial scrutiny and around whether Ohio will choose to file a state implementation plan for whatever is left of the Clean Power Plan, or whether we would instead let the federal government put a plan on us of their devising. So that was what the study committee recommended back in September of 2015.
Regarding the large corporations that did it as choice, what about smaller businesses that have been affected by it? Did you learn much about how those haven't been impacted by the freeze?
Well, sure, because consumers are paying higher prices for mandated green energy than they would pay if they simply purchased electricity made from natural gas. Ohio is blessed to have copious quantities of natural gas, which are just now being developed. There are five new combined cycle natural gas plants being built throughout Ohio. That is the resource the good Lord gave to Ohio. That is a clean burning fuel. That is probably where we need to put most of our marbles because it is the resource that God gave us. There is really no point in continuing with these mandates when they increase consumers' electricity bills. And in that regard, the Ohio Business Roundtable, a consortium of Ohio's largest businesses, just issued a report last week recommending that the mandates not continue and that they be phased out because of their view that it is not an economical way to proceed.
Most polls have shown that Ohioans say they support renewable energy mandates, and then even 50% of Ohioans who identify as conservative said they would be willing to pay $5 more per month or so for renewables. So,
well, that's great, because if they would like me to revise my bill to put a cap of $5 per month on every residential, industrial, and commercial customer's bill for renewable energy, I would gladly do it. Under the bill that I've currently proposed, there will be increases of more than $5 per month on people's bills. So if the view is that $5 is the correct amount, I'll be happy to revise the bill and cap the increased charge at that number.
So let's talk about this legislation. It's being written now that would it do? I mean, I've got a couple different stories that either it would freeze, it would continue the freeze, or it would make it optional.
What it would do is for the next 3 years, 2017, 18, and 19, the benchmarks would remain in place just as they were.
The freeze,
just as they were under the 2008 law. However, there would be no fines on the utilities for failing to meet those benchmarks, because that way we will know where the Clean Power Plan takes us in those 3 years. But then the mandates spring back into effect in 2020, and there will be fines for failure to meet the level that is required to have been met by the utilities in 2020. So there is no more freeze in the revised bill that I'm preparing. We have abandoned that idea, even though that is what the study committee recommended, because the governor has indicated he does not wish to continue with the freeze. So, okay, we will not continue with the freeze. We will have a goals-based plan for the next 3 years. And then at the conclusion of that time, we will go back to a mandates-based plan where the utilities can be heavily fined for failure to meet the benchmarks that apply in those years.
Well, doesn't a goals-based plan meet the definition of what Governor Kasich has said he will not support?
No. The governor has said he will not support a freeze. The governor said he will not support the outright repeal of the standards. My bill neither continues the freeze nor involves any repeal of the standards and the mandates. So I think what I proposed is consonant with what the governor said. In a meeting some months ago with some of his staff, I said, why do you want to continue with these mandates? They said, well, we think these goals are important. I said, well, I think the goals are important, and if you want to talk about a goals-based plan, I will be happy to work with you and devise a goals-based plan. They said, well, we think these benchmarks are important. I said, how do you define benchmark? They said, well, a benchmark is a goal that has to be attained. I said, no, that's called a mandate. So this issue between me and the governor is all about mandates that cause customers' bills to rise and put utilities under the heavy hand of government versus a goals-based plan, an incentive-based plan. And we see during the two-year period of the freeze that there has been plenty of additional solar development, for sure. And frankly, we have 11 previously approved wind farms that could have been getting built under prior law during all this period, and for whatever reason, they're not getting built. frankly, that has nothing to do with the freeze. It has everything to do
with the setbacks, right?
No, it has nothing to do with the setbacks because those 11 previously certified wind farms operate under the former setback law, not under the new setback law. So the question for those wind farm developers is, hey, you've had your plans approved for years now. Why aren't you building?
Hmm. Kathy Kowalski, go ahead.
Yeah, question that I have, though, is that there's a provision that I understood to say if you make any change to something that was previously permitted, then the new setbacks would kick in. And I've been told by some groups that they would then not be able to update or upgrade to whatever the newest technological improvements were if something came out now that was better than what they'd put in a couple of years ago.
Is that the case on your site?
That's not true either, because the Ohio Power Siting Board has approved numerous amendments to previously approved plans that involve nothing more than using a newer brand of turbine, and that does not trigger the new setback law. If they are going to move the turbines around or take a different footprint, that certainly would trigger the new law. But if all they're doing is installing a newer brand of turbine for the previously approved brand of turbine, the old setback laws apply, not the new setback laws. And by the way, even the new setback laws should not be any kind of a deterrent, because in many, many parts of the world, the setbacks are far more draconian than they are in Ohio. For example, in both Poland and Bavaria, the governments this year have adopted a requirement that the turbines be at least 2 kilometers away from any habited dwelling. 2 kilometers is upwards of 2 miles. The Ohio standard instead is 1,125 feet. That's a lot less than 2 miles.
The people in Poland, when I was there this summer, told me that that was basically shutting down all new land-based wind facilities.
That might be, but I point that out only to point out that the Ohio setback standards, even the new ones, are not draconian.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Ed in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ed. Hello, Ed?
Or is it Ted?
It might be Ted. It might be Ted. Okay.
So I'm listening to the representative there, and I understand some of the arguments. I get it. What about thinking forward to the future and industry? Lawmakers, politicians, we hear it, job loss, manufacturing jobs gone. What about the short-sightedness of not encouraging the development of these technologies to increase manufacturing capability in Ohio, therefore, obviously creating jobs and innovation for even newer technologies as we get better at it?
There is some merit in that, but what you are missing is Ohio can develop that manufacturing capability and export the parts and the other materials in the supply chain to states that are windier and therefore more suitable for wind farm development, or sunnier and therefore more suitable for solar development. There is nothing that requires Ohio consumers to bear the higher prices of wind and solar to facilitate that. Our existing manufacturing capabilities can easily supply those parts and those supplies to states that are both sunnier or windier than Ohio. So nothing in our Ohio state policy is retarding the development of that manufacturing capability. On the other hand, requiring all Ohio consumers and all Ohio businesses to bear the higher price of high-priced wind and solar power is going to cause job losses in the existing Ohio businesses that do not involve building wind turbine parts or solar panels. So you cannot simply look at the number of jobs to be gained by further development of the wind and solar supply chain without also considering the impact of jobs lost in heavy industrial user businesses like steel, who can ill afford higher power prices when they are so heavily dependent on electricity in order to produce the products that they have long produced in this state.
Ed, thanks for that call. Kathy Kowalski, what do we know about the development of the green technologies, wind and solar especially, obviously, is Ohio, I mean, is what Senator Seitz is saying is Ohio just doesn't produce enough wind or sun to make this all something to worry about in the future?
There's a lot of disagreement on that. State Senator Cliff Height in the northwest part of the state spoke last year at a conference I was at, and said when he went out, he was surprised by the number of farmers in northwestern Ohio who thought it was great because it was bringing in a lot of revenue. And I've been told that northwestern Ohio in particular has a lot of potential for wind energy. There are also a number of solar facilities going up as well, and there is potential for solar power in Ohio as well. The prices for both types of technology are also coming down a lot. Mm-hmm. I know there are some areas where wind energy is very close now when you do the levelized cost over a long period of time to what the cost for coal would be.
But not close to gas. Gas is what's setting the market price, Kathy. It's not coal. Coal is priced out of the market. Nuclear is priced out of the market. Wind and solar are priced out of the market. Natural gas is setting the wholesale price of electricity in the PJM electrical footprint.
Natural gas is cheaper than coal, but we still have a huge amount of coal generation in the state. So when one's looking at what are the different options for people to go to, I'm just saying it does provide, there is potential and they do want to develop that. The other issue is that you have, when you talk about the bill and the standards and setting it as goals-based, one of the questions that comes up is what happens then before then if it's voluntary between now and 2020 or 2021. There are some groups who say goals-based is the same as voluntary for that. But then there's also a question about what gets counted so that utilities could, for example, on energy efficiency, claim that anything they did in order to go on a steady basis to meet a goal or a target in 2020 is now voluntary, and therefore they should get extra profits for that in the form of shared savings, where if it were applicable every year, they would not be doing that. So that's just one of the things people have raised with me.
Well, whatever they do in 2017, 18, and 19, and as your previous guest commented, I think that was actually Kathy, the earliest we would expect any Supreme Court decision would be in 2017, and then the US EPA would give the states 2 years to file their state implementation plan if they chose to file one. So we're talking about clearly a 3-year delay before we know the final contours of the Clean Power Plan. Anything the utilities did in those 3 years would count towards the absolute requirement that they must meet it in 2020. So if they do nothing for those 3 years, they will have a very tall order of business in 2020 to go from where they are currently, 2.5% renewables, to what they must attain in 2020, which is, I believe, 5.5%. So if they dilly-dally around and do nothing for those 3 years, they will pay the piper in 2020. That would be a risk that I do not foresee many of them taking. So I believe a goals-based plan for these 3 years, when there is still uncertainty over the contours of the Clean Power Plan, is the appropriate way to proceed. And in a concession to the governor, we are reinstating the mandates as mandates in 2020, not changing, in my bill at least, not changing any of the percentages that must be attained by the end of the program, 12.5% for renewables and 22% for energy efficiency.
Jane in Danville, you're on the air. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I don't understand Senator Seitz, why he believes, when many citizens polled said they would pay more for alternative energy, they're willing to do that, why he believes that we shouldn't do that, that he somehow knows better than us and is protecting us. Because an 8% increase on the generation side is not that significant because half my utility bill is not generation. It's other fees added on by AP. Are you looking, because as a consumer, my bill's gone up 25% in 7 years, and I use 25% electricity because I replaced many old appliances.
Mm-hmm.
And AEP's president made $11 million last year, up from $2 million 5 years ago. Do you work for, the individual consumer, or are you working for for AEP's profit?
Okay. Let's let Senator Sykes respond.
Let me answer that question. The people that I'm working for are the ratepayers of Ohio. If you want to pay, first of all, if you want to pay more for alternative energy, you have that right now. The question is whether all Ohioans should be forced to make those increased payments. If you or even a majority of Ohioans are willing to make those extra payments, that's exactly what a voluntary program is all about, and you have that right now. The groups that I have consistently represented are the groups that represent the industrial users in this state. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce is on my side in this dispute. The Ohio Business Roundtable is on my side in this dispute. The Industrial Energy Users of Ohio is on my side in this dispute. The Ohio Energy Group is on my side in this dispute. These are large industrial users. You as an individual homeowner may not mind an 8% increase in your generation costs because, as you point out, it is only about half of your electric bill, and probably your electric bill is about $100 to $200 a month. But if you were a significant user of electricity, I guarantee you an 8% increase in your generation cost would be very significant. So the question is, do we mandate the socialization of these costs across all consumers, industrial, commercial, and residential, even those that are unwilling, or do we say, hey, if you want to buy renewable energy, have at it. You can buy 100% of it for all we care if you're willing to pay the price.
Bill, I'm not sure that, I'd be curious to see the documentation for the 8% figure.
That's easily attained. I have a sample of a bill insert. Finally, part of the last bill we passed requires the utilities to put these costs on the bill. So I have that here in my office. And was that Kathy asking that question or was that Ann?
Yeah.
I'll email it to you. I just got a copy in response to my questions of the PUCO, when are you going to get these bill inserts out? And lo and behold, in AEP's territory, they are out. You can now, if the lady who called is an AEP customer, she can look at that number, which is now on her bill, and compare it to the generation cost on her bill and do the math.
Jane, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. And Senator Sykes, thanks to you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Happy to be with you. Thank you much.
That's Ohio Senator Bill Sykes. He's chairman of the Senate Public Utilities Committee. We will continue our conversation and hear from a green energy business about what they think. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. A report from the Pew Charitable Trusts found that Ohio lost more than $560 million in wind and solar investments while state lawmakers mulled a freeze on clean energy mandates. The freeze is set to expire next year. We just heard from State Senator Bill Sykes, who's working on legislation to loosen the rules of the clean energy standards. Governor Kasich has said that he'll veto any effort to sideline the mandates again. Senator Sykes has said they figured out ways to appease the governor and move ahead with the changes. Still with us is Midwest Energy News reporter Kathy Kowalski. Joining us now is president and a principal of Dovetail Solar and Wind. That's an Athens-based energy company, Al Fraz. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having us on.
You dispute some of Senator Seitz's assertions, I guess, about the impact of the freeze on green energy businesses in Ohio?
Well, I not so much the impact, okay, because I don't think he said much about the impact on businesses like mine, which were dramatic, okay, and I can get into that a little bit more. But his comments about, you know, that renewables are just, you know, going to cost the consumers and businesses so much extra that, you know, in Ohio, wind and solar aren't cost effective, are just not accurate. You know, right now, you know, in other parts of the country, solar is booming, okay, and we are growing, yes, because there is considerable interest in it by both consumers and businesses, and he recognized that. But you know, we're not growing at nearly the rate that it's growing in other parts of the country, simply because we've sent out this big signal with the freeze that you know, we don't care to support renewable energy, and so manufacturers as well as investors have really pulled back in Ohio. And Ohio basically in 2010 we were 13th in the country as far as solar implementations. Okay, we dropped to 16th in 2012. And then when these freezes went in, we plummeted to 20. Now we're down to, in the latest data from 2015, we're at 28th in the country. And based on projections, we'll be in the 30s very shortly. Those are real jobs. I mean, we're getting passed by much smaller states. And this is based on total amount of solar installed. Okay, so we're getting passed by major states that have far less sun than Ohio, as well as states that have far less population. I mean, we're talking about states like Oregon, you know, who's way ahead of us now, Louisiana, Kansas, you know, so on. I mean, there's just numerous states now, and we're getting left behind because we've chosen to, you know, focus only and think that natural gas is the panacea for everything. Natural gas is a part of the transition to a cleaner environment, but away from coal. But it's not, you know, the one that we want to just put all of our eggs into. And you know, natural gas also at this point in time is not growing at the rate solar is. You know, solar. You know, this in the first half of this year grew over 50-some percent. Okay. And expected to grow for 2016 over 100% over what it was in 2015. So if we grow at 23% or whatever the number is, we continue to fall farther and farther behind.
Senator Seitz told our caller from Danville that nothing stops people from choosing to use alternative sources of generation. So he says, what's the problem? It's the big manufacturers, it's the big producers that are hurt harder. 8% to them is much bigger on their bill than it is to an individual, you know, homeowner.
Well, I understand. You know, if your business is very energy intensive, you know, the cost of energy is going to be a big factor. That's why a number of businesses are, you know, looking at investing in solar. I mean, we have done solar installations for a number of commercial businesses in Ohio. The utilities, you know, are also starting to look at it, particularly the non-regulated utilities are starting to go, you know, major because it is a low cost of producing energy. In fact, solar in other parts of the country right now, there are parts where it's 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour, which is very competitive with natural gas. In fact, more solar capacity was installed in 2015 than new natural gas capacity. Okay, so businesses and utilities aren't doing that because, you know, they're want to hug trees or you know, they want to be economical. I mean, uneconomic around this thing, that they just want to be benevolent. They're doing it because it makes good economic sense. And the challenge we have is the way we positioned it. Businesses are doing that in other places because Ohio is not, you know, in fact, we've taken down the welcome sign, okay? So, you know, we've missed out on major investments in manufacturing. You know, $1 billion solar plant went over in Buffalo, New York. Solar City announced that several years ago, and they're building that plant. It's coming online this year. We missed out on a major inverter manufacturer that went over in Indiana. There was a major expansion of a solar company that started down in Georgia and wanted to expand up in the Midwest, and they chose Michigan, and they are doing a major expansion in a former auto plant up in Saginaw, Michigan. And, you know, we're missing out on those opportunities because we don't send out a message at all that we support renewables. In fact, you know, the tone is, oh, renewables, you know, have at it if you want to waste your money. That's the message that came through from Senator Seitz to me, which is kind of nonsense. It really is. You know, he's missing out the fact that this solar industry and renewables in general are the fastest growing industries on the planet right now.
Well, what about his assertion that Ohio is not resource rich when it comes to wind and solar?
Kathy Kowalski made that based on reality. Reality is we get more sun than a number of other states that are making major investments in solar and getting big returns out of it. As the reporter talked about before, okay, you know, the Northwest Ohio has very good wind resources, and you know, the Lake Erie has even better than that. Okay, but you know,
there are issues with that. But
well, there's challenges to develop it. Obviously, it takes more development and resource to do it in water offshore, but the wind resources are phenomenal there. And again, we have an opportunity to really be an innovator again, rather than Ohio falling further back. And you know, if we want to continue to be a state that's in the 37s or 40-some, you know, ranking in with the rest of the nation, then we're on that track, okay? But this is a high-growth industry, and we are not getting our fair share of it because we are not, you know, putting out a welcome sign to encourage it at all by these kind of freezes and this pullback and this kind of attitude that it's not effective here.
Jim in Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. I'm calling. I'll try to make this as quick as possible. I'm listening to the arguments, and I just consider all the arguments as moot. The issue is, if you take a look at the transmission services that exist here in Ohio, which are aging, and they're actually aging across the U.S. Ohio's not the only.
We're talking about the grid, right?
We're talking about the grid, mm-hmm. Right. It's aging. It needs replaced. Then when you start talking about customers complaining that their prices are going up, well, they have their computers on 24 hours a day. They have 1, 2, 3, 4 servers on, going on 24 hours a day. They have all their phone systems on, charging 24 hours a day. The amount of electricity being used by both commercial and home usage, you know, a lot of people have 2, 3 large screen TVs. My God, those things just suck up an incredible amount of energy. And people are thinking, oh, I'll buy a big screen TV because they're economical. No, they're not. They burn twice the amount of electricity as the old cathode ray tubes do. So now you've got all this demand coming up that everybody wants their equipment supplied. They want a strong, unbroken current.
We're running out of time, Jim.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'll leave it there.
Okay. All right. There. Al Fraz.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Al.
No, were you going to ask something? Or?
Well, he didn't really get to his question. He's just making a statement that our demand is going up, our infrastructure is aging. How are we going to manage all of this?
Well, there are major investments going in to upgrade the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That is taking place, and there's at both the federal level as well as at PJM and MISO and so on, okay, to do that. And Ohio, in that sense, is a better place to do, for example, wind farms than some of the places that have seen major growth, such as the Dakotas, for example, because they don't have the major grid lines there. They've had to run major grid lines and add to the cost of implementing wind farms, whereas we are blessed with a major grid lines over, you know, across mm-hmm. Ohio, okay, as far as being able to take advantage of distributed energy and generation from wind and solar.
Kathy, did you have something to say?
I was just going to say on the distributed energy point that distributed energy gives you, from what I understand, more flexibility with your grid, greater resiliency, and ultimately, depending on technology, could let you manage things better to replace what's traditionally been called baseload power.
We're out of time. Al Fraz, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Al Fraz,
have more chance to talk about it. Okay.
Well,
I understand.
There's never enough time, but we'll have you again. Okay, Al Fraz, president and principal at Dovetail Solar and Wind down in Athens, and also Kathy Kowalski, reporter for Midwest Energy News. Kathy, thanks so much for staying with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.